You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Ko Jessica Toku Ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire, mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host, Jessica, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Ezra. E whai akine coming up on the show for our regular catch-up. I speak to ex-Simon Court about youth vaping, public sector cuts, and calls for the government to create a special humanitarian visa for Palestinians in Gaza with family connections to New Zealand. I also speak to co-founder of Vape Free Kids NZ, Marnie Wilson, an associate professor at the University of Auckland Bioengineering Institute, Kelly Burrows, about how effective they believe the government's new measures aimed at reducing youth vaping will be. Ezra, what have you got for us today?
I speak to pharmacy lecturer Dr. Jay Gong and clinical pharmacist Hoda Fakmi from the University of Auckland about a rise in opioid misuse among older adults and post-surgery patients.
He aha o whakaro. We would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces today, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or Waia mai rane, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Ka owe e wariwari e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kororo. Ano he pakihiri roki roki mā runga I te pai tuku tuku o irirangi poho. Mihari ki 95BFM irakati.com, and you can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on our website 95BFM.com.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
For our weekly interview, I spoke to ex-Simon Court about the government's new measures aimed at reducing youth vaping, significant cuts to the ministries for primary industries and health as directed by the government, and calls for more from more than 30 organisations, including World Vision, Save the Children and Greenpeace, for the government to create a special humanitarian visa category for Palestinians in Gaza with family connections to New Zealand. Here is that interview. The government has recently just announced measures aimed at reducing youth vaping, including stricter penalties against retailers caught selling to minors. Can you tell our listeners how you believe this approach will be effective?
Well, vaping's had a really important role in bringing our smoking rates down quite quickly over the past few years, and it's going to remain an important tool to achieve our smoke-free targets. When a smoker switches to a less harmful product, that's a good thing. That's a win. The big concern is, and many people have raised this, is that it's not just people who are smokers who are taking up vaping. It's young people, even school kids. Principals have raised this with the government as an urgent issue, and they've also made a point of talking about this in the media, so it's quite a well-known problem. Talking about kids vaping in the bathroom at school or even in class having a sneaky vape. So it's really inevitable that the government does have to take some kind of action here. What the government is trying to do is strike a balance by preserving smokers' access to less harmful vaping products, by cracking down on retailers who provide nicotine to children, and removing that impulse buy sense that disposable vaping products have, that might have special appeal to young people. So that's what we're trying to do with the changes.
Associate Police Minister Casey Costello has said that there are only 15 enforcement officers for all vape retailers in Aotearoa, which is about 7,500, and that there's no plans to increase this number. How can you be confident that these harsher restrictions will be enforced?
Well, this type of lawmaking really is around self-imposed compliance. When the penalties are going to be so high, then retailers will know that if they're caught, they do face very severe penalties and fines. So I'm sure that over time, the compliance and enforcement approach, you know, will have an effect. The first person who's caught selling vapes to kids and who ends up being prosecuted and facing tens of thousands of dollars of fines, that's going to make the paper, that's going to send a very strong signal this government's serious about it.
Last week we also saw the Ministries for Primary Industries and Health announce significant cuts as directed by the government. Why are these cuts happening?
Well, households are facing economic realities of higher living costs and higher mortgage rates, and most people I know have already been making cuts to their own household spending to try and soak up some of these extra costs. And now our government is also willing to acknowledge that we do have higher costs and we need to act on the same economic realities as households. I compare that to the 6 years under the previous Labor government when MPI, and with this one Ministry for Primary Industries, their staff numbers increased by 53%. Now we're seeking a reduction, or they've offered a reduction of 9% in their staff numbers. I mean, that's hardly what Labor's called austerity. We're not talking about people on the front line, or compliance officers, or people working at the border. These are back office roles, many of which are duplicated. And some, for example, like policy analysts. Well, when the government is setting the policy agenda, we don't really need these ministries having a whole bevy of policy analysts coming up with ideas that are not in the coalition agreement for execution.
The Ministry for Primary Industries announced that it will be cutting 231 roles, while the Ministry of Health is considering cutting 180 roles. Your party leader, David Seymour, called this good. Do you stand by this comment?
Well, of course, it's unfortunate and sad for individuals who have to find new employment, but Act's duty is to the wider public, to the people paying government's bills. Act campaigned on winding back Labor's spending growth and the enormous increase in staff numbers at central government from around about 48,000 to 63,000 in 5 years. So it is good that government departments are reducing staff costs. We are seeing the government departments respond on the government's commitments. It's good because if we want to keep funding essential services like health and education, we do need to be constantly reviewing spending in other areas, and that includes who is employed doing what and is it actually adding benefit, producing outputs that lead to good outcomes for Kiwis.
Do you have any concerns about how significant job losses set to happen across the public sector will impact households who, like you said, are facing higher living costs?
We expect it to impact households positively because if central government reduces its spending as a proportion of the overall economy, that will reduce central government's effect on inflation, which means that interest rates should come down sooner. And it will also mean that the public sector isn't competing for resources with the private sector, another thing which is holding up costs in the economy. So it is good. Households will benefit from seeing a smaller government. Firstly, it'll cost less, and they will also be able to, over time, see the private sector expand to fill the gap that the public sector has unfortunately taken so many roles on and delivered inefficiently.
What would you say to those people who are set to lose their jobs? Do you think that they would share your optimism in this?
Well, I am always concerned when I hear that people are going to lose their jobs. I have personally experienced what it's like to come to the end of a contract and to have to worry about paying the bills. I'm sure that many, many New Zealanders have been in that situation and would empathise with those who are facing that situation now. But I would also encourage them to be positive because every week tens of thousands of New Zealanders find new jobs and there is plenty of opportunity out there. We've had a shortage of labour in many parts of the economy for some time, and you know, skilled workers are in demand.
I wanted to ask you about one more thing, which is that we've seen a coalition of NGOs, charities and academics call for the government to create a special humanitarian visa for Palestinians in Gaza who have familial connections to New Zealand. Is this something that ACT would consider recommending to your coalition partners?
Well, of course, in principle, we should accept refugees based on their level of need, and I'd expect Palestinians would rank very highly in that regard right now. The difficulty with a special humanitarian visa, though, is that it brings in people above and beyond our existing refugee quota. And so, you know, ACT would say, why don't we just increase the general refugee quota, assuming that many Palestinians would qualify. But that also has to assume that we have the resources and the infrastructure to actually accept more people and help them integrate into New Zealand. But there may be a way around this. ACT has previously proposed allowing local and community groups to sponsor refugees, effectively inviting families to New Zealand on the basis that their costs are guaranteed and covered privately. And I imagine all of those marching for Palestine would be more than happy to chip in and open their homes. So there may well be some practical ways around it.
So we wouldn't be looking at creating a special visa, though, like how we did with Ukraine, creating a two-year temporary visa for Ukrainians with family in New Zealand?
Well, even if we did that, it wouldn't be very practical, given that it's not possible for people to leave Gaza right now. It's under a blockade by Egypt and Israel. So whether we created a visa or not is kind of irrelevant. But what New Zealand certainly should be doing is reviewing whether we can accept more refugees, more people in need from around the world. And if that was the case, then I expect that Palestinians would be able to come to New Zealand if they met that needs test.
That was ACT's Simon Court on the government's youth vaping measures, cuts to public services, and their rejection of calls to create a special humanitarian visa for Palestinians in Gaza with family in New Zealand.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
We'll be right back. We're just going to take a short break. Keep it on the B.
We'll be right back. I'm actually renting a camera right now.
Shit.
Yeah, really handy for trying stuff out, or if you need something for a one-off.
Yeah. Would you rent a movie, though?
ProGear have the best rental prices in Auckland on camera, lenses, and lights. Canon, Fujifilm, Nikon, Sony, Allen Crom, you'll find it at ProGear, 3 Railway Street, Newmarket, or online at progear.co.nz.
The Vista Foundation 48 Hours is Aotearoa's largest guerrilla filmmaking competition.
And if you are a fresh baby team who hasn't entered before, then tune in to 95BFM Breakfast all week for your chance to win a free registration.
Whoa!
The winner will be drawn on March 28.
The Vista Foundation 48 Hours Filmmaking Competition. Registrations open now. Shoot weekend is May 17th till 19th.
For more info, head to 48hours.co.nz.
Good day, Frank.
Yeah, it's high tide now as well, so yeah.
Yeah. What is it? Was this 3 foot, is it?
Yeah, at least. So yeah.
Yeah. Is it onshore? Yeah, onshore's a good one, eh?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, cool. Yeah.
Oh. Here comes a good one.
You get it.
No, it's okay, you go for it.
No, I insist.
Okay. Oh, damn, I missed it.
No, that was close though. You did really well.
Thank you. Actually, I might head in. My board doesn't feel properly waxed.
Yeah, I think I'll join you. It's getting a bit messy out here now anyway.
Yeah, so we're just going to get a flat white.
The 95BFM Surf Report. All the surf, all the time. Weekdays on Breakfast and Drive. Thanks to ProGear Photographic.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM. Apologies for a bit of background noise there. We've got some construction going on outside, if you can hear that. But we love seeing all your texts coming in. Keep them coming. Text in on 5395 to let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Last week, the government announced a complete ban on disposable vapes and higher fines for vape retailers and individuals caught selling to under 18-year-olds as part of its crackdown on youth vaping. I spoke to co-founder of Vape Free Kids NZ, Marnie Wilson, about how effective she believes these measures will be in stopping youth vaping. Here is that interview. How effective do you think this is going to be in stopping youth vaping?
Look, there's no question that upping penalties for retailers who are selling to underage, to kids is a good thing. But at Vape Free Kids, we just don't feel that's going to be effective. And the reason is that there's not enough enforcement officers to actually enforce these fines. So throughout New Zealand, the figure that the minister's been giving is 15 officers for the entire country. Now, there's about 7,500 retailers that sell vapes at the moment, so you don't have to be too clever to work out that 15 officers is going to be a pretty hard ask to actually have any proper enforcement. So the penalties alone, we just don't feel is enough. They need to be looking at the not only upping the enforcement, but also looking at the easier option is looking at the availability of the vapes in the first place and reducing the number of outlets.
We also saw that the government went forward with banning disposable vapes. Do you think that this goes far enough from preventing young people from accessing cheap vape products?
Again, unfortunately not. I think the government's made these statements about high penalties, banning disposable vapes, and they sound really good, but when you start to dig deeper, you realise that the effects aren't necessarily going to be there. And with the disposables, the issue we have now is the industry is really good at pivoting and coming up with new products that fit the new legislation. So we've already got pods, which are cheap, and you can buy, I believe, for about $10 a pod vape, and then you can buy the replacement pods. So they're going to be completely legal because they're refillable. So, you know, it's not enough. Yes, it's great that those disposables have been banned. Yes, it's great that penalties have gone up. But overall, that is not going to be enough. We need to have a proper comprehensive strategy that looks at how vapes are going to be made less available in our communities.
How widespread is youth vaping here in Aotearoa?
Yeah, it's really quite sad when you look at the figures. The latest figures we've got is the New Zealand Health Survey, which those figures were released in December, and they showed that the number of 15 to 17-year-olds vaping daily in New Zealand has doubled in the past year. So it went from 8.3% in 2021-22 up to 15.4% in 22-23. So that's 15.4% of 15 to 17-year-olds, which is a heck of a lot. And the other thing that's very concerning is that the Ministry of Education's released some statistics a few months ago, and that actually shows that primary school students are among the most stood down for vaping across the country. So 6 out of 10 regions in New Zealand, primary school students are stood down more often than high school students. So we're definitely seeing it going down the age groups too. And I've got a kid in primary school and a kid at intermediate, and absolutely vaping is out there. I think anybody who wanders around our streets, unfortunately, and looks, you know, or maybe has children or has nieces and nephews or friends with younger kids, we know that vaping has become quite normalised and out there in our communities, and it doesn't have to be that way, you know. We need to do something about it.
What more do you think the government could be doing to stop youth vaping?
Yeah, I think we need to look at Australia and what they're doing over there. They've taken a much more comprehensive approach, and I think the big thing they've done is they've recognised that big tobacco is looking for its next generation of nicotine addicts. You know, we've got a sort of few T-shirts we've been trying to print at Vape Free Kids, and on the back of them it says, "Big tobacco needs little addicts." And that's the bottom line here. The government in Australia seems to have, you know, realised that it requires some real tough measures to actually put tobacco industries in their place and put our kids first. So what we'd like to see, the availability go right down, and we'd like to see the coalition government stick to the promise that National made pre-election, which was to reduce the number of outlets selling vapes down to 600. It's currently over 7,500. We'd like to see their promise that they made and have that go down to 600 outlets to make a huge reduction. And that's one thing we'd like to see. We'd also like to see vapes really put back into the category of a smoking cessation tool. You know, they're supposed to be introduced for adults who are smoking. So we'd like to see plain packaging on them. We'd like to see warnings on them. They contain nicotine. We'd like to see an end to all these colourful, bright, kid-friendly packages and flavours. All those things that just say to us, hey, Big Tobacco's trying to lure the next generation in, you know. There's a whole lot of things, in fact, we would like to see. So I don't want to kind of take up all your time listing them, but another big one is support. So we've got a group of over 2,000 parents, whānau, community members, health workers, all on our group. A lot of them are really struggling with kids that are addicted now to nicotine because of vapes, but there's no support out there for them. So we think a really big part of what's missing with the government announcement and what we'd like to see is increased support for those young people who are now addicted to nicotine and want to get off it, but they can't go to Quitline because Quitline just helps smokers. There's nothing youth-focused, and we feel that's a big missing part of it. We also want to see an education campaign. In Australia, it's all over bus stops. It's all over the place. There's big posters up saying, you know, if you're, you know, if young people don't vape, it's not good for your health. We don't have that here. We don't have any public education, and we know there's a lot of scientific information out there to show that nicotine affects our developing kids' developing brains. So there's a lot more that can be done, and we feel that this latest announcement falls short. I really feel that, you know, the young people out there listening, uni students and other students, have got heaps to offer in terms of good ideas and how perhaps we can be working to reach more young people. So I'd love to encourage anyone listening to check out our group. We're on Facebook, Vape Free Kids NZ. We're on Instagram. And we have a website, vapefreekidsnz.org. So please reach out to us. Please let us know if you have any ideas, because we think that ideally young people are going to be the ones that can reach young people.
I also spoke to Associate Professor at the University of Auckland Bioengineering Institute, Kelly Burrows, about her thoughts on the government's crackdown on vaping. I started off by asking Burrows what impact she thinks the recently announced measures will have on reducing vaping among young people.
Yeah, I'm really hoping that this will have an impact. So the previous government tried to introduce rules to get rid of disposable vapes, but they didn't go far enough. They only got rid of vapes with removable or rechargeable batteries. So the new policies, or when they come in, are hoping to properly get rid of disposable vapes. And I think this will have a really big impact, because these products are really accessible. You can get them for sort of under $5 per vape. So they're really accessible for younger people, easy to get hold of, and as well as sort of, you know, enabling those younger people to really take up vaping. It's also an environmental concern, in my opinion.
And the government is also increasing fines for vape retailers and individuals who are caught selling to minors. How effective do you think these measures will actually be?
So it's hard to know, because a lot of the new rules that have been brought in, it's hard to know who's really policing or enforcing these rules. So it sounds like there's only sort of 15 staff members that will be, you know, checking in on shops to make sure they're adhering to the rules. But I do think that having that, the risk of those bigger fines are going up from 10,000 to 100,000, I really hope that that will at least put a bit more fear into the shops who have, you know, who do regularly sell to underage people. And I do hope it will have an impact. But I think that the government could go further. I mean, I think one thing that they could do to try and reduce youth vaping is to get rid of some of the flavourings. There's thousands of different flavouring options, and this is one of the things that really appeals to youth. A study in the US showed that, I think they surveyed a few thousand young people in the US, and 75% of them said that they would quit vaping if they could only get tobacco flavour. So I think that really shows that those flavours are you know, a really key thing in young people taking up vaping.
And this also comes as international research has shown that e-cigarette users experience similar DNA changes to the cells lining their cheeks as smokers. What can you tell us about what this means for better understanding the long-term health effects of vaping?
Yeah, this is a really interesting and sort of groundbreaking study. So, we don't yet know the long-term health effects of vaping. So it took at least 50 years for smoking to be widespread in the community to really make those links between lung cancer and different lung diseases or other diseases from smoking. Vaping has only been around for about 20 years. So, you know, it's going to be a while till we see the long-term health effects. So what researchers like me and other people around the world are doing are trying to look for these early markers or early links that indicate what the long-term health effects are. So this study that just came out, as you said, looked at cheek cells, and they looked at how the DNA changes in smokers and vapers. And they found similar changes in the genetics or the DNA or the how the DNA is working in both people who smoke and vape. And these changes have sort of been linked in smoking cohorts to the eventual development of lung cancers. So I think this is a really important study to sort of get some of those early ideas of understanding the long-term health effects of vaping and showing that possibly we will end up having similar outcomes in people who vape as those who smoke.
Just how close are we to being able to correlate vaping with increased risks of diseases like lung cancer, like we see with smoking?
Yeah, I mean, I honestly think it's still quite a long time away, because I think people won't really believe it until, you know, there is those people actually developing these diseases. And as I said earlier, it's sort of, you know, someone might start smoking when they're 20. They're not going to start seeing these effects of, for example, lung cancer or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease until they're 50, 60 or 70 years old. So, you know, it is really the long-term use of these products. So I think we're going to have to wait another 10 or 20 years before we sort of really see this happening in widespread in people. So until then, all we have to go on is what we can look at in research, so including looking at cells, looking at animal studies, and looking at short-term markers in humans. And, you know, hopefully more and more evidence will come up to sort of have those early ideas of whether there are changes so that we can sort of prevent it from happening, in the population in the next 10, 20, 30 years.
That was co-founder of Vape Free Kids NZ, Marnie Wilson, an associate professor at the University of Auckland Bioengineering Institute, Kelly Burrows, on the government's recently announced measures aimed at reducing youth vaping. Why do you think less students are choosing to study at university?
Well, because being a student isn't sexy anymore.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
We'll be right back. What'd you guys do on the weekend?
I got into a political debate with my extended family.
I color-coded my bookshelf. How about you?
I made a gross-out comedy film about a budgie smuggling crime spree in 48 hours.
Make a debatably genius movie in just one weekend. Early bird registrations open now for the Vista Foundation 48 hours. Get your team together and mark your calendars for the shoot weekend May 17 till 19. For more info, head to 48hours.co.nz.
A group of emperor penguins huddled close, moving together in synchronized waves. This is Universal Harmony.
Radiating togetherness with positive energy. This is Universal Harmony.
As wholesome as fresh sliced sourdough and as empowering as winning a prize at school assembly. This is Universal Harmony.
Tuesday nights from 10 till midnight are reserved for Universal Harmony with Dr. Snickers, only on 95BFM.
Putting the bubble back in your moe. That's Universal Harmony.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM. Research from the University of Auckland has highlighted a rise in the prescription and use of opioids in New Zealand, particularly among post-surgery and older adult patients. I spoke to pharmacy lecturer Dr. Jay Gong from the University of Auckland about the implications of these findings on post-surgery patients. Here is their interview. Your studies reveal that 1 in 10 patients continue using opioids post-surgery. Can you please discuss the significance of this finding?
Our study is one of the first studies in New Zealand that's looked at sort of patients from all age groups and all types of surgeries. It does focus on patients that have received opioids on discharge, so it's not everybody that's undergone surgery. We did use, in terms of what we call prolonged opioid use or persistent opioid use, we did use quite a broad definition. So depending on what you look at in terms of literature, 1 in 10 could be high, could be on the high end. What this does mean that there is a significant portion of patients who continue to use their opioids after 90 days once they're prescribed opioids on discharge.
What are some of the primary factors contributing to the continued use of opioids in post-surgery patients?
One of the main reasons why we worry about patients prolonged opioid use after 90 days is that it does seem to be associated with markers of harm such as rehospitalization, such as opioid dependency, opioid misuse. So in some ways, I guess you could say that opioid use after 90 days is a proxy for potential harm to come related to opioids, or it does have some associations with harm related to opioids.
How can healthcare providers adapt pain management strategies for patients recovering from surgery?
Yeah, I think that's a very difficult question to answer in some ways because pain is such an individualized treatment. And also, in terms of this study, we don't really look at, whether or not the opioid is appropriately used or inappropriately used, because we don't know. Because in our data, we do not have indications of opioids continue opioid use. We don't know if the patients are using it for, other reasons besides surgical recovery. So it does mean that we need to have more research into the subject in terms of looking at potential reasons why opioid is continued for this patient, and whether or not we are addressing patients' pain and post-surgery recovery appropriately, whether or not it is around patients' education on how to use opioids, whether or not patients' perception around opioids, because, you can see that there's a lot of media, including, I'm doing a radio interview with you, there's a lot of media sort of information that can scare patients about using opioids. But our message is not really about avoiding opioids. Our message is that opioid continuation after 9 days might be helpful, but opioid usage normally, under the guidance of physicians and your surgeons, entirely appropriate for the purpose of recovery.
You would say a lot more research needs to be done into opioids in general?
Yeah, definitely, because in New Zealand, I was a bit surprised when I first started my PhD that there was very little around prescription opioid use. There was some around illicit opioid use, and you can get data from, the Drug Foundation. it's very different. It's important for people to also understand the difference between prescription opioid use, where you're being prescribed by a physician for a set condition to be given opioids, and also illicit opioid use, where you know you might be using opioids outside of indication, you might be using opioids for other reasons besides pain management, and you might be obtaining opioids through non-illegal means.
I also spoke to clinical pharmacist Hora Fatmi from the University of Auckland about the impact shown on older adult patients. Your research highlights a rise in opioid prescriptions among older adults. What are the key implications of this trend?
We have highlighted a concern because opioids is a high-risk medicine and they can be problematic in several cases because, yeah, we're talking about a class that is a high risk and have been attributed to opioid-related adverse events, so things like overdose, dependency, abuse, hospitalization. And in this case, it is problematic because we don't actually know the reason for this rise in trends. And the population we're talking about, which is older adults, can have an increased vulnerability to opioid-related adverse events because of the body changes, their body changes. So the more you age, the more likely you'll have a compromised kidney function, for instance, so more susceptible to side effects. Also with older adults, they're more likely to be on multiple medicines, also known as polypharmacy. So yeah, you can be on a medicine that can interact with opioid and that can cause side effects. So that's why opioid therapy should only be considered when potential benefits are likely to surpass risk. It should be prescribed with extensive monitoring and regular assessments just to determine the need for continuation.
What unique risks do opioids pose to older adults, and how can doctors ensure safer prescribing practices for this demographic?
So as I've mentioned before, because older adults are quite susceptible to adverse effects in general, and opioids carry a high risk of adverse effects. So yeah, older adults, as I said, they can have compromised kidney function, they can have compromised liver function, and these are really necessary to process these medicines, so they're more likely to experience side effects. So yeah, they are in higher risk to experience that compared to other populations. And to try to prevent that, prescribing opioids should be quite limited in this population. So some people would still need opioids for sure, and they would need opioid for a long time, but not every patient would need opioids. So it's really good to keep monitoring the therapy for side effects, and we should really do some regular assessments to determine if this patient needs opioids till now or deprescribing would be a better option.
How can policymakers use your research findings to develop strategies and policies more tailored to older adults?
This is a very good question. So the main aim of the study was to raise awareness around opioid use in older adults. And I think we've already been doing that, and we've already done that. So future research is actually needed to determine whether this increase in opioid dispensing is a consequence of unnecessary prescribing or it reflects like proper pain management practices. And we do need to establish evidence-based guidelines and to inform policymakers about opioid use in that population. Specific population. So I guess the main aim was to raise awareness about this so policymakers can know that, all right, future research is actually needed to know why increasing trends is happening in this specific population, that the risk is higher compared to other populations.
Is there anything else you'd like to share about your research?
Healthcare professionals professionals, like we're already doing a great job, but as healthcare professionals, it's really important to talk to patients and their whānau about potential opioid side effects. So side effects like constipation, you know, drowsiness, risk of falls, breathing problems. It's really important to get the patients to be informed. And, you know, if a patient notices they've been on opioids for a very long time, I think it's quite important to initiate a conversation with their healthcare provider and say, you know, should I still be on this? I've been on it for that long. Do I still need to continue? Because it could still be appropriate, but if it's not necessary, the prescribing would be a very good option. And I guess also funding research exploring the reasons why opioids have been increasing in older adults is quite crucial. So, yeah, you know, with scientific research can help us with so many unanswered questions. So, yeah.
That was pharmacy lecturer Dr. Jay Gong and clinical pharmacist Hoda Fahmy from the University of Auckland on the rise of opioid use among older adult and post-surgery patients.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa, mō tēnei wiki ne te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kororo mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Monday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Axe Simon Court, co-founder of Vape Free Kids NZ, Marnie Wilson, Associate Professor at the University of Auckland Bioengineering Institute, Kelly Burrows, Pharmacy Lecturer Dr. Jay Gong, and Clinical Pharmacist Hoda Fahmy. Ni rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.